Hey, check out our cool new intro here.
Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview from peterbcollins.com. Today, we take a look back. It's been 2 years since we've been subjected to the Russiagate narrative in the corporate media and from Democratic leaders. Aaron Maté writes for The Nation and reports for the Real News Network. I consider him to be a measured skeptic of the whole Russiagate story. And he updates us today by noting that Russiagate is largely missing from the debates and from the political commercials in the crucial midterm elections for the House and the Senate. There's a lot more to our conversation, and it's all made possible by listeners like you who subscribe. People like Anna Gordonier, Jerry in South Portland, Siri Walgren, and Hillary Hamilton just renewed an annual subscription. I'd like you to join them. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber, you land on the sign-up page, and it's easy, just a couple of clicks, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or the $50 annual subscription. I'm glad you're listening, and I appreciate those who support my work. We've been enduring the Russiagate scandal now for at least 2 years. And Aaron Maté is one of the measured skeptics who's rationally reported on the arc of this narrative. And he returns to our program today. He writes for The Nation, reports for The Real News, and joins me via Skype. Good to talk to you again, Aaron.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
My first question is not in your report. Have there been any recent sightings of Rudy Giuliani?
That's a great question. He's been quiet recently.
Is he in the witness protection program somewhere?
Maybe in the Trump protection program just by keeping him silent.
Yeah. Or maybe the witless protection program.
There we go.
That would be That's the one. Special for him. I surrounded myself for this interview by media reports related to Russiagate. And before we get to yours, I just want to note that here on November 1st, the New York Times' David Sanger has a blockbuster, Mystery of the Midterm Elections, Where Are the Russians? BuzzFeed a couple of days ago, Russia is meddling in the midterms. The White House just isn't talking about it. Last week, Kathleen Hall Jamieson released her book and stated it's clearer than ever the theft and leaking of Democratic emails were key to Clinton's election defeat. And even my friends at Who, What, Why, who've been doing great election integrity coverage for the midterms, in an otherwise great piece about the vulnerability of the optical scanners and the networks they're connected to, and this is particular to Florida in this case, the headline reads, Florida election offers target-rich environment for Russia's agents. And there is no hint in the article that there's any evidence that Florida is particularly vulnerable to any kind of Russian hacking. And all of this distracts from what I believe are the domestic culprits, or at least suspects, for the outcome of the 2016 election that's been blamed on Russians. And you point out in your reasoned piece, with just days to the midterms, Russiagate is missing in action. So, Aaron, amid all this noise from the other media outlets, you've maintained, I think, a very laser focus, and I appreciate that.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, it's been interesting to note that just the contradiction between these dire warnings of the last 2 years on two fronts. One, that, you know, that we're under Russian attack constantly. We had the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, saying a few months ago that the warning lights are blinking red. Nonstop talk about a Russian threat to the midterm. And then coupled that with this constant suspicion and in many cases conviction that Trump is a Russian dupe or a Russian conspirator. And now all of a sudden it's gone. We're not in the most – what is supposed to be this consequential historic election. The dominant issue of Trump's presidency is missing. So that's the mystery I think worth pondering borrow from David Sanger's headline you mentioned, the mystery of the midterm elections, where are the Russians? I think the mystery actually is, where is Russiagate? Because why are we not hearing about this issue that has consumed Trump's presidency? I think the answer is, for the same reason that there are no Russians for David Sanger to identify that are messing with the midterms, Russiagate has been hyped up. It's been built on a lot of it's been built on conspiracy theories and innuendo and the fear of Russia and fear mongering about Russia, but not actually concrete evidence. And I think that its absence from the midterm campaign ads, midterm campaigning, media, like mostly in media these days, mm-hmm. speaks to the fact that actually there's not much there to go on. And those who have been peddling this for the past 2 years know that they can't go to voters with anything because they don't have any proof of anything, because so much of what has been suggested about Trump and Russia is evidence-free or has collapsed upon scrutiny.
And you open your piece at The Nation. Campaign ads and debates are mostly avoiding the Russia investigation, according to Politico, in favor of other issues important to voters, like the economy, health care, and taxes. One study of political ads over a 4-week period through mid-October found that only 0.1% of all of those ads, and there are millions of them, aired in congressional races, mentioned Russia. There were zero mentions of Russia in ads for Senate races. So it is interesting that the Democrats, together with corporate media outlets who have promoted this narrative as a death threat to what's left of our democracy, are suddenly silent about it when it comes to standing for re-election or opposing a Republican incumbent.
And I think it's important to really think about the dynamic here of why a group of people whose job it is to report on the news, pontificate about the news, and to shape the news if you're a politician. Why, after 2 years of being so vocal about one issue, why when it's time for a pivotal election that determines many of their futures, especially politicians, why all of a sudden they're so silent about it? I think the answer is that in the short term for the past while, Russiagate has been profitable for its proponents, for media outlets. It gets ratings because it's sort of entertaining and salacious and exciting. For politicians, it gets them on cable news. I mean, if you're a Democratic politician willing to talk about Russia, you will get a spot on cable news. There was a piece in the Daily Beast a few months ago saying that some Democrats are even frustrated that they can't get booked on cable news unless we're talking about Russia. Mm-hmm. But now, though, there are actual consequences. Now it's not just a matter of getting, you know, yourself a cable news appearance. Now you actually have to get elected. And if you're a media outlet, you know, you have to cover the elections. And so there's just right now there's actual consequences. And given that there's consequences, there's stakes. Now all of a sudden it's been cast aside, which should raise questions about both the validity of the issue itself and how real it is, and also the sincerity of those who have been pushing it for these past 2 years.
And Aaron, let me underscore what you just said about the quietness of Russiagate. It's getting much less play on MSNBC. Part of that was the diversion of the Kavanaugh hearings. And I just saw a report on cable news ratings for the month of October. And Fox News has spiked upward. MSNBC is flat. And CNN is just down slightly from the same period in September. And, of course, there are many reasons for this. I don't want to say that the ratings flatly indicate that Russiagate has lost its appeal. But MSNBC is very strategic, ruthlessly so, about pursuing ratings by ignoring important stories that they should be reporting every day in favor of the catnip of Russiagate. But it is fair to say that their ratings have suffered, and Fox has shown gains during the month of October.
Well, listen, that's very interesting. I mean, it's very convenient for me to hear that, that as soon as MSNBC starts focusing on an actual issue, that the ratings dip. I mean, as you said, we should be cautious. I mean, who knows what kind of, if we can draw a sweeping conclusion from that. But, I mean, it is worth noting that, that I mean, if it's true that that represents a sort of a general thrust of where the viewing public is at, that represents a possible reason for why this has endured for so long. MSNBC has fueled this because it's gotten them ratings. When they turn to issues, issues that they themselves have ignored, it's harder to sustain people, in part because they've been feeding people on this diet of Mueller and Russiagate for so long that maybe it people have become conditioned to not be able to take in much else, which, again, I would lay squarely on the fault of the media and those who capitalized on Russiagate. But now I think we're starting to see some of the consequences of that. And hopefully, from my point of view, not being a Trump supporter, I'm hoping that the frustration with Trump and the desire for checks and balances and the fears about, creeping authoritarianism and all the bad things that Trump is doing will be enough to get people out to vote, and that people have not been sort of turned away or sort of discouraged from being involved in politics by the fact that, Democrats and their media outlets have been so focused on such a passive issue such as Russiagate, where there's not really of any direct concern to anyone's lives. It's just basically we're putting all our faith in Robert Mueller.
Yeah. And, Mueller has been a little quiet in advance of this midterm election, hopefully reflecting on the disruptive role that James Comey played in the 2016 cycle. At the same time, we did see the indictment of Elena, help me with her name, Kushinova?
Yeah, you know what? I can't say it any better than you can.
All right. Kushinova. That's my best.
Kushinova, yeah. Yeah.
All right. So she's an employee of that dreaded troll farm in St. Petersburg, the Internet Research Agency. And she was indicted by Robert Mueller. This led to, an update from Rachel Maddow, who was, drooling over the news, but you put it into context. So explain to our listeners what you think is significant or not about Mueller's latest indictment, claiming this kind of influence operation aimed at the United States in advance of our midterms.
The only thing significant about the case of the IRA is that it's been deemed to be so significant by law enforcement and by cable outlets like MSNBC. Just a small correction. She actually was not indicted by Robert Mueller.
Oh.
She was indicted by the Justice Department because I think in part because – see, Mueller has run – so Mueller indicted this Russian troll farm, the IRA, back in February.
Mm-hmm.
But then something unexpected happened. The firm hired a really good lawyer in D.C.,
yeah.
An excellent lawyer, and they defended themselves. The Russian firm is called Concord. So Concord defended themselves, and their lawyer's argument was actually that, it's not even clear what crime you are charging my client with. You're accusing my client of a conspiracy to interfere in U.S. politics, but there's actually no such crime in federal statutes. And Mueller is now scrambling to explain what the crime is, and it looks like the judge has ordered Mueller and his team to come up with an explanation soon, and it looks like possibly that case is going to be dismissed unless Mueller can come up with an explanation. But so far, at least from my reading, the defense lawyer has been pretty convincing, and so I think because of that, this was spun out to somebody else, possibly to avoid Mueller further embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And so now this new indictment, the defendant is the accountant for the IRA. So the IRA, in case anyone's not familiar with it, the Internet Research Agency, it's been around for a long time. It's basically a clickbait marketing firm. They make all kinds of content, you know, most of it fake, to get clicks. And the accusation is that it's been used as part of this sophisticated effort to interfere with U.S. politics. Certainly, it does create posts about divisive social issues, and it has, as the latest indictment details, it has concocted fake accounts in both conservative and liberal personas. So there is definitely a political aspect here. Now, one possibility is it's simply just a commercial clickbait operation in which they, you know, in which basically you, you know, which happens all over the world. And it's possible that the people running it also have their own political views that they're trying to, like, you know, infuse into it. But it's like the idea that this is some massive conspiracy and that it could have any impact on anybody is just laughable. If you look at the ads that they make, they're all very juvenile. They spend very little money on them. I think the total social media ad spending in over 6 months in 2018 by the IRA was $66,000, which is just nothing.
Right.
And so this defendant, Elena Kushanova, she's not even accused of taking a part in the so-called – in the actual social media trolling. She's just accused of being their chief accountant. So they the only actions in the indictment that they cite of hers concern her, quote, meticulous record-keeping and management, unquote, of the bookkeeper. But this is supposed to be significant, and amazingly – except for my article and a few other places, I mean, it's been taken seriously and is signs of a Russian attack on the midterms, to paraphrase a headline that this got from Mother Jones.
Yeah. And in your article, you also build on some of the arguments that my colleague Gareth Porter presented in his recent analysis of the Facebook the claims that Facebook was so critical in persuading American voters in 2016 because of this figure of 126 million people who saw these posts. And, I understand I've placed media in political campaigns. I do understand the metrics of advertising, including digital advertising, and even 126 million, which is potential impressions when you actually look at the language used, is minuscule. It means that they scrolled past it, and, you know, some of them may have actually read it. Facebook acknowledges that only 10% of the posts in anybody's newsfeed are read on an average daily basis. And so when we put this into rational context, it just screams as hyperbole, exaggeration, and a way of avoiding looking at the domestic actors and domestic factors that actually influence the outcome of the 2016 race.
The amount of bad faith it takes to get to a point where we're talking about these 126 million Internet Research Agency posts on Facebook is just staggering. First of all, it means avoiding all those huge domestic factors that you talked about. Gerrymandering, voter suppression, the dominance of billionaires buying elections and, you know, other dark money forces. Neoliberal Democratic Party whose candidate didn't even campaign in Michigan or Wisconsin because her own staffers believe that the more she campaigned, especially in Michigan, the worse she would do because of her economic message. Mm-hmm. So it takes ignoring all that. And then on the issue of, for example, this 126 million figure itself, you're right. Gareth Porter pointed this out. I say it here too. Even that figure, it's widely cited. You know, 126 Americans saw Kremlin content from the IRA. But actually, first of all, understanding what the content itself was, most of the content was not even about the election. Most of it was not even around the time of the election. It was either during the primaries or it was after the election. And it was all just basically, you know, generic clickbait trash that's no different than any other piece of clickbait. But even if you take it to be the most sophisticated messaging in the world, which it wasn't, even if that was true, even the 126 number is based on a totally a very creative take on what Facebook actually said. So what the actual quote is, the original quote from Facebook is this. It's from Facebook General Counsel Colin Stretch. He's testifying to Congress. He says, "Our best estimate is that approximately 126 million people may have been served one of these IRA stories at some time during a two-year period. Okay, so 126 million is an estimate of people who may have been served one piece of content. Again, most of that have nothing to do with the 2016 election over a two-year period.
Right. And Aaron, I feel it's important to note that the Trump campaign spent $82 million on dark targeted Facebook ads. And so when you compare the, you know, potential impact, the stuff linked to the IRA, even if it was shared and, you know, got viral pushes from people who actually read it and clicked on it, it just is infinitesimal. My buddy over at San Quentin on death row, he said, this is one of those cases where they've made a 10 out of a 2.
I think being a 2 is way too generous. No, honestly, like,
right.
It's literally is like I think it's a 0 because most of these ads. I mean, what does it tell us if the leading luminaries of politics and media are so fixated on talking about something that is such a non-existent impact on one of the most important elections in U.S. history, and their dogged insistence on continuing to talk about it? Like, what does that tell them about their level of sincerity and their seriousness about winning? It's really for the Democrats. It's about covering up for their awful, embarrassing loss and refusing to change. I mean, it's like you have to be extremely devoted to failure to be so fixated on such a moronic explanation for your loss. I mean, it's stunning.
And it infects the media in such an insidious way. This week, I interviewed Columbia journalism professor Michael Shudson, and he wrote a book about why journalism still matters. And up to the point of recent history, his book is interesting and has some valuable points about objectivity and the way reporting has changed since Watergate. But when I asked him about Russiagate, and about the what I called media malpractice and yellow journalism of the New York Times, he moved into defensive mode, and he did not have any explicit criticism of the coverage of the New York Times. I kind of bullied him a little bit and explained my perspective, and he kind of shrunk away saying, well, I guess you've focused on this more than I have. But I was stunned that a guy who is portrayed as one of the leading academics on journalism in this country didn't have any critical thought about Russiagate. And, you know, your interview, I guess it's about 2 months back now, with James Risen, who was a victim of the attempt by the Obama administration to force him to testify against CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling. And his skepticism about government, about the intelligence community that he's been covering for decades, it is shocking to see the way he treated your skepticism. And basically, he didn't hang up on you, but he abruptly ended the interview because he didn't want to deal with somebody who didn't accept his assumptions.
He did hang up on me. He ended the interview by hanging up on me.
Okay.
And just to explain there, I mean, like the story there, it's fascinating. And it's his behavior, I think, speaks to the dynamic you're identifying in the media today. And I think, I mean, just stepping back, I mean, the most important book for me on that is Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman, which talks about how in a corporate media culture that is pretty much run and dominated by powerful sectors, that is going to, by powerful interests, like the media is going to reflect those interests, both in terms of what it covers and how it chooses to cover them, but also in terms of even just to be it talks about various filters that ensure conformity, and one of them is that basically if you want to be accepted into the mainstream, you have to, there are certain bounds in which discussion is allowed to happen. And unfortunately, on Russiagate, for a bunch of different reasons, you've had the underlying tenet that Russia is engaged in a massive interference operation against the United States, and that the Trump campaign might plausibly be complicit. If you question that, you're excluded and you're put on the fringe. And so James Risen, I was shocked, really, given his admirable record, at how credulous he is in accepting the claims, some of the underlying claims behind Russiagate. And his publication, The Intercept, unfortunately propagated that with the story that I was interviewing Risen about, where basically they reported on this document from the National Security Agency that purported to attribute a cyber operation targeting U.S. voting systems to the Russian government, to Russian military intelligence. And The Intercept played this, reported this as a really big deal, that basically evidence that Russia was trying to penetrate U.S. voting systems. But if you – now, the main criticism that was allowed of that piece was that the NSA document that The Intercept reported on didn't show the underlying intelligence. But actually, it's worse than that. The document itself actually shows that the Russian government itself doesn't even that the NSA doesn't even accuse the Russian government with any certainty whatsoever. It very clearly disclaims that it's only a matter of contextual information and analysis judgment that attributes this particular cyber operation to the Russian government. It specifies that it's not confirmed information. But The Intercept sort of lost that distinction and reported this as if this was like some explosive news. And really, all the story was some document that they got leaked by one analyst saying that contextually he thinks that the Russian government might have been involved in ultimately a very minor operation, which is basically impersonating a voting systems operator and sending an email to states. But The Intercept blew that out of proportion. I pointed that out to Risen, and he had nothing to say in response, the conversation devolved from there. And that's unfortunately, yeah. That's an example where it's Russiagate has enabled this sort of cult-like behavior where, you know, the facts and rational thinking just no longer apply.
Well, and it's disappointing as well to see The Intercept, which produced some great reporting from Glenn Greenwald challenging the narrative of Russiagate. Greenwald did engage in a kind of debate with Risen after Risen joined the outlet. But Glenn has been focusing on Brazil and a few other topics, and I don't presume to tell anyone, reporters, what they should report on. But I do notice that he has gone silent on the Russia story, and I don't know quite what to make of that.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't draw any conclusions from just in terms of Glenn's choices. I mean, he lives in Brazil, and I know Glenn very well. And I mean, he's been on Russiagate from the beginning. He is not silenced in any way there. He has total free reign. But I do think that, you know, aside from Glenn, there has been an institutional failure there, and not just at The Intercept, but there has been instead of putting James Risen to write articles about how Donald Trump is a traitor, and instead of vastly exaggerating the significance of and actually misinterpreting the significance of this NSA leak that they got, The Intercept could have been challenging Russiagate much more and devoting resources to it, not just relying on Glenn, but they haven't. And I think it's worth pointing them out, not to make them wrong or to blame them, but the fact that you have this publication that was founded on being adversarial, and founded with a mission to be skeptical of government claims and to be aggressive, the fact that on like the definitive issue when it comes to U.S. intelligence claims and the U.S. intelligence community of the last 2 years, they've been so credulous. It just speaks to where our media is at. Because if the most adversarial publication can be so soft and credulous, then what does it say about everybody else?
Aaron, I know you have a tight schedule today, so I want to wrap up with a quick discussion of the Facebook purge of independent media outlets. And some of those that were purged were also on the op or not list that was murkily published by the Washington Post. They kind of walked back from it a little bit. But this was a murky group that alleged that certain outlets were Russian tools because of the reporting that they had done. And I find it very disturbing that some of those were subject to the purge, which is now almost 3 weeks old, at Facebook. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
this is one of them. I mean, there's been so many shameful episodes in post in sort of Russiagate era media, but this is one of them. So November 2016, you have the Washington Post publishing a story. It's called "Russian Propaganda Effort Helped Spread Fake News During the Election," and it's based on this McCarthyite blacklist from this group Proper Not, which is completely anonymous. We have no idea who they are, who funds them. And Proper Not provided a list of websites to the Washington Post that Proper Not deems to be agents of Russian influence, and then included all sorts of sites like Black Agenda Report, I believe, and mm-hmm. Consortium News, and all these alternative media sites. And some of these were since suspended in this recent Facebook purge. And we know that Facebook literally works with the Atlantic Council. This NATO, Gulf, European government, U.S. government-funded think tank. And the Atlantic Council, this shop there called the DFR Lab, helps them identify what's fake news and what's not, and what groups are fake or not. And among the people who've been purged were progressive voices and progressive sites. And it's just – I mean – the journalist Max Blumenthal says that, you know, it's clear to him that this is part of what Russiagate was designed for. There was a conscious effort to spread fear about Russian disinformation for the specific aim of cracking down on dissent. I'm not sure how deliberate or not, or whether this is just how these systems go. You know, this is what always happens. But the point is that's been the result. The irony of this concern about foreign government meddling and disinformation has meant that in the name of it, we spread a lot of disinformation, as we've been talking about a little bit, in terms of this fear of Russian interference. And then we also end up cracking down on social media and using it as an excuse to have thought police, and thought police who happen to come from a heavily compromised institution like the Atlantic Council. And who knows who is even behind Proper Not. It's that McCarthyite that even some of the experts are anonymous. We don't even know who they are. So it's a scary time, and you know, we can only hope, Peter, that as things get more and more ridiculous, that more outlets will join people like you and I in calling this out. But I mean, for now, it's been striking to see the silence.
Indeed. Aaron Maté, please keep up the work you've been doing, and we'll check back with you as conditions permit.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this interview with Aaron Maté. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.